listening to Around Comics.
Are listening to Around Comics episode 448. Is that right? 448? I think that's right.
All right.
I'm Ryan. You're Christopher Niesman. This is Around Comics. It's Thursday night. We're live on YouTube and Facebook and Twitch and Twitter and all those spaces. And tonight we are talking about martial law.
The comic book. I am the law.
I am the law. No, that's a terrible.
Oh, that's the other guy. That's the other guy.
Sylvester Stallone. Yeah. No, it's Martial Law by Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill, first published by Epic Comics in 1987. The series is known for its dark humor, over-the-top violence, and its irreverent take on the superhero genre. This was my Trade Talks pick, and I'm really excited to see what you and Tom, whenever Tom shows up, have to say about it. He'll be here.
He's dealing with the children's.
Yeah, his last text was running late, everyone's crying. That's being he's sort of a single dad tonight. So he's dealing with his children. Everyone's crying. Yeah, I know how that goes. I've been there. But what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm really angry about this. I had a huge blind spot in my comic book reading history, and this is a book that like 16-17 year old Chris would have just poured over these pages, and it was a blind spot for me, and I'm reading this and I'm just like, holy shit, this is so good now. This mm-hmm. would have been amazing in 1987, 1988. It was probably a little too subversive for my fragile being in 1987.
Well, where were you at in 1987? Were you in Southern Illinois?
Well, yeah, I would have been in Marion. I would have been in eighth grade, probably going into high school. I was 88 to 91.
Yeah. I mean, that would have been a tough thing for you to even find at that time. Yeah. I think like I was, so 87, I was 16. Well,
I went to Carbondale was a college town. And so there was, I mean, it wasn't like a lot of like rural areas. There was a SIU Carbondale is there. So it was a big university town, and it was a pretty cool comic shop. And I know that they had a lot of indie comics that I just, as a 16 year old, you know, redneck, I wasn't looking for that. You know, DKR was probably about as far as I went into you know, anything like off of the mainstream at that point. And that's a Batman story, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I didn't mean that as much as, although, you know, it was an epic book when it came mm-hmm. out, which is interesting. And there's a interesting story about that I watched an interview with Pat Mills talking about sort of the creation of this and how it came to fruition, and it's interesting how it sort of happened. But no, I just meant like, yeah, at 8 years old, or no, you didn't. Yeah,
no, I was like, eighth grade. I was like, you know, 14, 15, yeah. 14, probably.
Yeah. Your parents would not have approved. I know. I was 16, and I remember picking this up on the stands, and it was something that, you know, I was at that period in my life of reading comics where I was starting to kind of like, not get, you know, not with millions of other mm-hmm. comic book readers at that same time period, where it was like, I was going away from the mainstream comic stuff. I was looking more at independent comics, looking more for the first time, like being exposed to British comic book creators and British comics and black and white comics and that kind of stuff, you know, because I certainly grew up Marvel DC, you know, that was all I really
you were
read.
Coming, you were coming out of your John Byrne phase, and I was still knee deep into it, right? You know, I was buying at that point, I was buying back issues of Uncanny X-Men, trying to, you know, get that full Byrne Claremont run. And then I actually kind of warmed to Dave Cockrum, who I didn't really love to begin with. And so, you know, for Kevin O'Neill, for me to have looked at this, you know, in 1987, I would have been like, that doesn't look like John Byrne.
No, it does not. It certainly does not. I mean, I think initially I was probably just attracted to sort of like the cover and the idea of it, and you know, the hyper violence of it, not really suspecting what was, you know, the subversiveness and the political messages and all that other stuff. And I don't even think I didn't get half of that stuff when I read it the first time. Like, I didn't understand most of it. You know, I probably picked up stuff this last time reading it again in my 50s. And it was like, oh, he's talking about World War II here, or he's talking about, you know, like just different things that are in the book, which is fascinating.
Military industrial complex. And
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's interesting to sort of like go back and see how ahead of its time it really was, and unfortunately sort of like how topical it still is.
That's what's scary about it is I'm reading it now and I'm just like, holy shit, this is relevant now. We're, you know, it's you know, the whole cult of personality and you know, the government, you know, lying to protect you, and you know, it's I don't want to get too deep before Tom jumps in with us once he gets his children, you know, in the box.
Silenced.
we'll talk a lot about Pat Mills and the story, but you know, I was introduced to Kevin O'Neill in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Was, you know, I had probably seen like a Green Lantern comic or something, you know, before that, but that's really where I fell in love with Kevin O'Neill, is probably, you know, a lot of people did. And he was such the perfect artist for this, because so much of that subversive messaging is in the background of his art, and that he is so, that's what made League so amazing, is all of the little stuff that was put into the backgrounds that just kind of creates that world. And this, you know, the signage and the different little, you know, messages that are scrawled on walls and that kind of stuff just really paints the picture of this, you know, really crappy place that they exist in.
Well, it's interesting, and that goes back to what I was saying earlier. So I had listened to an interview with Pat Mills talking about it, and you know, he said essentially how the, you know, it sort of came about was that Archie Goodwin, and you know, was working, and
the great Archie Goodwin,
the great Archie Goodwin, and he was heading up the Epic Comics, you know, import or whatever you will, and they were talking to Kevin O'Neill. And they wanted him to draw something for Epic. But Kevin didn't really, you know, for whatever reason, he didn't really vibe with some of the writers or American writers. So he actually brought Pat Mills in on the project.
And this is what year is this?
This would have been like probably 85, 86, something like that.
So we're like
probably 86.
Like 14, 15 years after Pat Mills basically created 2000 AD.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because he had created 2000 AD. He had been written. But they just, I mean, it was just a different world where you didn't have, you know, the British invasion kind of had just started. You know what I mean? And so in comics, I should say. And so you didn't have that. You didn't have a lot of those British writers coming over to the U.S. and having success. And even still to this day, I don't know that Kevin O'Neill and Pat Mills, outside of Martial Law and a few other things, have had a ton of American success for whatever reason. But, so he was saying though that, so he pitched the story and initially Martial Law was, the name of the book and the character design was O'Neill. So he had already had the name of the book. We're going to call it Martial Law. This is the character. And then Pat sort of, you know, quickly put together a premise to pitch to Archie and to Epic of like a kind of, he said it was kind of a straightforward, almost like a cop book, like a, you know, almost like, it was like a murder mystery kind of cop book, crime book, was initially what I was thinking. And then once it got approved, you know, and Archie kind of approved that, and he was like, okay, yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. Well, Watchmen had come out, and that was kind of a whodunit weird, you know, superhero. Yeah, sure, so there was they were probably saying, oh yeah, there's appetite for that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. And then, you know, but then, you know, Pat talks about like, you know, then I started to think about it, and it was like, well, you know, this is a superhero book to, or this is going, I want this to reach people that would reach, that would read Marvel comics. Like he was looking at it like, I'm not going to try and write a book that's going to be released by Marvel, by Epic, but it's only going to kind of like gear towards like an art house crowd or people, you know, that already like my work. He's like, how do I kind of get this to have a broader audience?
Well, he wanted 16-year-old Brian Salazar.
That's right. Exactly. He did. And so that's when he had the idea of like, okay, well, what if he's a cop, but he's a cop for superheroes. And, you know, he talks about despised superheroes. He kind of hated superheroes and not necessarily like, you know, the 60s, you know, 50s and 60s or like the classic stuff, but like the stuff that was coming out in the 80s, you know, that the extreme superhero stuff. He just fucking hated all that shit. So he's like, okay, we're going to make him a superhero killer, a cape killer. And that's where that idea came from. But then, like you were talking about, like the graffiti and the world and all that. Once he sort of pitched that to Kevin O'Neill just went off. And he's like, well, let's do this and this and this. And he said he really created the world that martial law lived in. And like all the graffiti and the signs and all that stuff. And he's like, that was all Kevin O'Neill. Like,
the sayings on the t-shirts and
yeah, all that stuff.
Nuke me slowly, you know?
Right. And it was really fascinating to listen to him talk about, like, you know, this true collaboration on the book, because it is so much of it is the visual look of it and like the world that they live in and that kind of thing. And it does, like, I think it borders on, it certainly goes over like into a ridiculousness. I mean, there's so much ridiculous, but there's also this weird, like it's grounded in this sort of weird, dirty satire world, like that we can kind of see, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like you can kind of see that was
2000 AD, right? You know, what mega city, right? You know, that was, so this is, I mean, it's not revolutionary for Pat Mills. I think he was taking a lot of the ideas and concepts that were in Judge Dredd in 2000 AD and kind of reworking them for an American audience a little bit more, right?
Yeah. You know, and this is what I started to think about, like, you know, you think about all the comic book creators, the British comic book creators, right? Like almost all of them that have been successful have this sort of like anarchist sensibility to them. This sort of, you know, I mean, it makes sense. Like in the 80s, the punk rock sort of do it yourself.
Margaret Thatcher. Yeah.
But you know, the funny thing is, and I love that. I mean, you've known me for, you know, forever now. And it's like, I love that attitude. Like I have a very anti-authoritative, rebellious nature in me. And so I vibe with that sort of attitude. I don't think there's enough of that in the world today, really. But you know, those guys were something that I certainly connected with. But the thing that's really interesting to me is like I look at it where most of the time the outcome of that or their target is generally the US.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, you look at like 80s England and Margaret Thatcher, and it's like,
yeah,
you live in one of the most fucking like fascist sort of states on the planet. I mean, you know what I mean?
I mean, if you're looking the UK in general, what was going on in Northern Ireland at that point with the IRA and the Troubles. And I mean, they had plenty of fucked up shit going on in England and the UK.
But it's always interesting to me, like these, this sort of like anarchist attitude is always sort of directed at, you know, in comics, it's like directed at superhero comics or directed at, you know, Western comics, in the United States or the U.S. government and that kind of thing. And it's like, it just kind of struck me as interesting in that way of like, when the fuck are you going to point your finger at, you know, how come you assholes aren't pointing your finger at your own goddamn government?
Well, it's always easier to, you know, point the finger at someone else. And we are bastards.
Well, sure. But are we any more bastards than the British? Really? No, I mean, not in the history of the world. We're not even close. We haven't come close to the shit that they've fucking done.
Distant. Distant second or third.
Hey, there he is.
What's up? How's it going?
You got those? You tied those children up and put them in a closet finally?
They're still awake. Everyone's just up.
You look exhausted, Tom.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah.
Welcome to martial law. It sounds like you needed a little tender love and
love and understanding.
Love and hatred. Yeah. We were just kind of talking about the origin of martial law a bit, and I was talking about Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill and how they kind of maybe pulled a fast one a little bit on Archie Goodwin with the initial pitch of martial law was going to be sort of more of a straight crime comic. And then it turned into this like satire about superheroes and authority and, you know, all sorts of different political things that, you know, that it is today that maybe Archie wasn't quite expecting initially.
You could do weird shit at Epic, right? That's where Electra Assassin was Epic.
There were some. I think he talked about it, and as everyone does, Pat Mills talked about like the reverence that he had for Archie, because what Archie did was he protected his creative people from the blowback, from that kind of stuff, you know, that if there were complaints, if there were, you know, people above them that were sort of, you know, fighting about it, it rarely ever reached the creatives. And that's why people loved to work for Archie and with Archie.
Have you ever heard anyone say anything but glowing remembrances of Archie Goodwin? I mean, way back whenever we talked to John Byrne, it was like, who did you love to work with? Things like Archie Goodwin was the best.
Beloved. Sure.
But the beloved
Archie. Beloved Goodwin. Archie Goodwin. Yeah.
Beloved.
So for those that maybe have never read the book before, we can give you just, I want to give just a brief sort of synopsis maybe of it. And then I'm really interested in what you guys have to say about this book, because I could talk about it forever, but because neither of you have read it before and I've read it multiple times, but so I'm really excited to see what you guys think about it. But so for those that have not read it, it is a book written by Pat Mills, art by Kevin O'Neill. It came out in 1987 from Epic Comics, the Marvel imprint. And it's a story of a guy. What are you doing?
Sorry.
It's a story of an ex superhero, or at least a superpowered soldier, who is now a government sanctioned police officer whose job is to rein in rogue superheroes. Because now, after this, genetic engineering, like superheroes are everywhere. People have powers. Almost everyone has powers, it seems like. And there's a lot of these ex-soldiers who got superpowers to go fight in a war, and now they're home and they really don't know how to deal with the fact that they have these superpowers and aren't in a war any longer. And so they do all sorts of crazy bad shit. And it's this crazy world that is also is set in the fictional city of San Futuro.
Futuro.
after like the big earthquake that eventually is going to take out California. It happened in this world, and now they're living in this apocalyptic sort of city. But martial law, he's tasked with finding a killer. Someone is running around. A cape is running around. The sleeper man. He's running around killing women that are dressed like Celeste, the superhero, the female Wonder Woman of this world, basically. Yeah. And all the heroes are essentially like thinly veiled copies of Marvel and DC superheroes. So it's a lot of satire and that kind of thing. And martial law eventually thinks that the number one superhero in the world, the public spirit, is actually the killer in disguise. But I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but yeah, he's trying to expose that guy for his wrongdoings, and the story goes from there. So that's just a brief sort of synopsis.
He's got to get Homelander.
Yeah, you know, that's the funny thing, because I reading it again this time around, I'm like, man, I cannot imagine that that book was not inspired in some ways
by Garth Ennis was reading martial law. You know,
for
Garth
sure,
Ennis,
right? Like there's law. Yeah. So it's interesting. And I'd like to, at some point, I'd love to talk about if they ever made a martial law TV show, who would we think would be cast? Who would be cast as those characters? But anyway, so what did you guys think about martial law? Your first,
I was going to say, I don't know if you could do a TV show of it and it'd be quite the same way, because like the Kevin O'Neill art is such a element of like why it kind of works, you know, because you know, when we talked about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, like his style kind of like doesn't sit neatly in any particular thing. Like sometimes it's like it leaves you like kind of like, what kind of story is this all the time? Because you're not quite sure how funny it's supposed to be or how horrifying it's supposed to be. And like, it's always like a little funnier than what you think the scene should be, or it's a little scarier than you think, like in a good way, where it's sort of like, you're not quite able to like hone in on exactly like what's happening in it at any point, which is, I think, what kind of makes it work. Is like it kind of is bouncing around between all of these things that like
it does this weird oscillation between like murder mystery and war comic and political satire, and it's bouncing around from all
social
of those
commentary.
It's a lot.
No, but and also it borders on the edge also of like it could easily become ridiculously, you know, funny. It is funny at times, but it could really tip over into sort of like silliness, or just so ridiculous you don't take it serious at all. But I think it's balanced really well by like, you know, the grittiness and the serious, at times very serious sort of commentary on things that it has.
Yeah. I mean, there's a guy whose like superpower is that he has a tail.
Well, he's almost a superhero.
He's almost. It's sort of like if you imagined like this story drawn by somebody who kind of doesn't straddle all those things quite the same way, it wouldn't quite work. You know, it'd be too serious. It would be too serious. It would be too like
silly.
It just wouldn't quite like land the way it does, like with him, you know, as one of the creators of it, is like, it keeps you sort of unsettled in exactly what it is. I mean, there's like moments where like in the action of it, it isn't a million miles away from what a kid would imagine a fight would look like, you know, like drawing it in a notebook, right? Like there's where he's like kicking the bad guy in the balls, or like, you know, like it's sort of like, you know, obviously the craftsmanship is of a higher level, but like the spirit of it isn't a million miles away from like that sort of like fantasy
no, you're,
horror like level.
absolutely right, because I know, you know, there's parts of, you know, obviously Kevin O'Neill's an extremely talented artist, but there are parts of it that look very, I don't want to say amateurish, but almost out of place, like purposefully wrong. You know what I mean? Like there's times where like he'll put a person in a pose that like anatomically doesn't work, or it looks like someone who doesn't know how to draw would draw it, like a kid, like you know, like you said, like it looks like a kid's drawing in some ways. But it's like, well, it's Kevin O'Neill. I know if he wanted it, he wanted it to look like that.
It's doing, reason, he's doing it purposefully. Before we started recording tonight, we were talking about Jim Rugg, who I think is another artist who is very adept at doing that, because Jim Rugg can draw in any style that you ever want. But he will, you know, like intentionally do things that border on amateurish, or, you know, like the kid who drew with the ballpoint pen in the notebook, and grew up. That's, you know, and Kevin O'Neill was doing that way before Jim Rugg was, right?
Yeah, I think it is fascinating, because I love his art. But there's times when you look at it and it's like, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I don't even really know how, you know what I mean? Like, it's so different than most everything else out there. Do you know, like, is there another Kevin O'Neill type artist? Can you name another artist that's like Kevin O'Neill? I don't know that I can. You know what I mean? Like, it's so unique to him.
I mean, it's interesting too, because within like the issues, you know, it's particularly the action scenes that at times like border on sort of farcical like layout of like anatomy, and like the action is so like, this is where my hero crushes this guy's head into a wall, you know, like that level of sort of like fantasy, right? But then like you'll see a page where he's talking to Kiloton, you know, who's also, and like the layout of the page is within Kiloton, who's huge. So there's like these very like extremely well crafted and like well put together parts mixed with like these sort of very like farce like approaches to like violence or how characters look. And it's all sort of happening within one story, right? And it's sort of like, oh, okay. You know, like when he's not in his costume, you know, in comparison to like sort of like when he does have his costume on, like his costume is ridiculous. It's a ludicrous costume.
It is amazing. It's amazing in every way.
Yeah, it's that in and of itself, you could talk for like 45 minutes about like the costume, right? Like just this ludicrous like leather suit, like S&M.
Go get the gimp.
But then at one point in the book, like there's another character sort of talking about how it's his girlfriend doesn't know that. Lynn doesn't know. And she's writing about his costume. And on one hand, she's making, you know, saying the same thing, how ridiculous it is. But then she talks about like the barbed wire on his arm. Is that saying something deeper about like his own punishing himself and like, you know, sort of like, it's, you know, just trying to describe it in different ways or looking at it from a different. So it is. And that's like one of the more fascinating things about this book to me is that I'm not even sure. I'm not still at this point sure exactly what Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill are trying to say with this book. You know what I mean? Like martial law is technically, you know, the hero, right? But he's not.
Yeah,
maybe, but he's not really always. He's not really presented that way all the time.
Yeah,
he's certainly not presented as a flawless hero.
No,
and he's presented as, you know, like his alter ego even questions his morality, and he even makes jokes about like his own sadistic nature and how much he enjoys, you know, kicking the shit out of these superheroes. And so there's not like a nobleness to what he's doing. It's, you know, what I mean?
I don't
like,
hate him. Well, maybe I just dislike him. No, I hate him.
But there's also, yeah, exactly.
But there's also like fundamentally a pointlessness to him. Like the thing that like is interesting about like their approach to superheroes is like all the superheroes, you know, like they're in this place, like San Futuro, right? And it's sort of like they're all over there, right? And there's a bunch of them and they're all surplus. They're surplus superheroes left over from the war. And it's sort of like, sure, we have him to like go and round him up, but it just sort of feels like they've been cordoned off into like their own place. And it's sort of like, whatever happens, happens, you know? And it's like, so it's like, it's weird because his character has sort of like the gravitas in a funny way of like the Punisher or like one of these characters. Right. Like, I'm going to clean everything up. But really, when you look at it, like from a wider distance, it's sort of like, oh, okay. Like,
it's kind of meaningless.
It's kind of meaningless.
Futile.
Yeah.
There's all these superheroes and like they're all killing each other and other ones are killing me. And it's like, and they're not in charge of anything. Like they're not like, there's some superheroes who are important to the world, but then there's all these surplus ones who like, who cares? Gee, you know, like they're just a problem.
Could it be talking about the military industrial complex and like homeless veterans? And, you know, that's, I mean, it's pretty easy to draw that line, right?
I think going back to, you know, like, you know, World War II, you know, all the veterans coming back from World War II and just being all fucked up and not knowing how to survive in sort of like post-war Americana and, you know, and as a country and as a government, you know, healthcare system, having no idea how to care for any of these guys or even what was wrong with them. And that's war after war. And that's been every war since. We still are in the same fucking place every veteran, you know, group that has come home after a war. Is we still don't know how to take care of these guys. We still don't know what to do with them or how to help them or and they don't know how to deal with civilian life. And, you know, and it is this, you know, constant cycle because of the way we're just always at war. We're just always creating
soldiers. You just hope that, you know, a few of them don't get the idea to go up into a fucking bell tower with a sniper rifle.
Yeah, you do. Surprisingly, you know? Not as many do as, but I think that it's even just more of like, you know, the idea that we are, you know, we as a society create this mess in trying to protect our society. And how crazy is that cycle? Like, you know what I mean? Like the idea of, hey, we need to protect the United States, so we're going to create a bunch of super soldiers, but then they're going to come home and create chaos. And now we have to have someone to protect us from that, so we can go out and create another bunch of super soldiers so we can protect this crazy society. You know what I mean? Like it's this weird cycle that we just caught in and we can't ever get out of. And, you know, because we're so afraid of fucking everything and everyone outside of our own little bubble as a country. It's
I like the section where martial law is getting manipulated by the police chief or whoever he is. Yeah. And it's like, you know, everyone has their price and martial law like does kind of you know back off and doesn't, you know, go through with, you know, with his gut instincts, because he's like, well, you know, if I'm part of the system for this, it's going to help a lot of people, and then I'll just, you know, and then I'll come back and I'll get him after that. And I thought that was an interesting, you know, part where it's like, yeah, even martial law has its price.
Or, you know, like, I don't know, to me, like, so much of it is like part of the humor to me is that he's not different than the other one, the other capes that he's chasing. He just happens to be assigned a different thing, but he also creates chaos. he's also like, right, like that's part of the pointlessness of like, he's getting manipulated by somebody else who's like, essentially like, can we keep this guy busy doing something, you know, like,
yeah,
and like, we can direct him to do whatever things he's doing, right? So like, in a way, like, I don't know, I found, you know, the fact that it's obviously like inspired by stuff like Watchmen and, you know, Dark Knight, but very, in that sense, it was very different. It's like a much funnier viewpoint of like, actually superhero, like, is kind of pointless and they're kind of dumb and they're kind of like, you know, easy to manipulate and like all this stuff that I thought was like, actually like a much more cynical viewpoint of what superheroes are than sort of like even something like Watchmen, you know, where it was sort of like, there's so many of them there, we call them surplus and they're, you know, like just getting, you know, killed left and right by this other guy who's not that much better than them, but we've like made him convinced that he has some purpose, you know, to like handle this stuff, you know. So I, you know, I've read a couple issues before. I had not read like all six of these together in one shot. And I was sort of like, I was like, this is very different. I liked it a lot. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It does take a little bit for your brain to sort of like adjust to like, oh, like, I don't quite know what this story is, because the art is so like not, it doesn't fall into like sort of classic, like, this is a superhero story. Even the, The Boys, you know, has a style that's like, ah, yes, those are what superheroes look like, right? Like, everything looks kind of like goofy in a, not in a bad way, but just sort of like, that's what they're doing. They're making all these heroes look like buffoons or like weirdos and like,
monstrous, like, and
monstrous, strange. Like, none of them are normal. Even the ones that are supposed to be normal aren't normal looking. They're weird. They're like, you know, Celeste, who, the sirens, who are supposed to be these modified like sexual manipulators, like, she looks weird, you know, like
she's got a waist that's like, you know, 2 inches like, around, and giant tits, and a little small tiny head. Weird head.
Her head's smaller, her head's than her smaller boobs. Than her bust is one of the is lint. So, you know, like, so even in that sense, even those ones are weird looking and sort of like, I don't know. You look at them long enough, you're kind of like, what's happening?
Yeah, it's, you know, you had talked about how what DKR and Watchmen, so serious that this has those elements, but actually introduces some humor and satire in ways that, you know, we probably hadn't seen up to that point. And I see that as, you know, this has got to be, you know, influential to The Boys. I was, you know, the whole murder mystery aspect. I see a lot of Powers in the roots of Powers in this book. You know, there's a lot of what I ended up, you know, reading and being some of my favorite comics. It's like, I don't know if those comics are around without martial law. So yeah, it was exciting to read this and go, oh, that's where they got that from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, that's the other thing too, is like, in six issues, there's so many fucking ideas. Like, there's so many just like crazy wild, and that may only last for a page or two, and then it goes on to something else. But it's like, you know, so many things that you could run with and go in other directions and tell completely other stories on just, you know, one idea. Like you said, like the, you know, Nearly Man, the guy who, you know, is
sorry, the Nearly first, Man.
Yeah. He's just like, he just has a tail and like, just that alone, like, you could do a whole story on just that guy.
There's fucking hard sci-fi concept in here. It's like, you know, when did Interstellar come out? It was like 2016, 2015. But that whole concept of, yes, he was gone for 2 years for him, but because of Einstein's, you know, theory and faster than light travel, it was 25 years, the gap. And it was just like, when I saw Interstellar, that like blew my mind. And, you know, you read the whole David Green, you know, books and whatnot, but for them to do that concept in a 1987 comic was just banana pants.
Yeah. There's so many wild, crazy things. And like I said, it straddles the line between so many different things, you know, superhero comic, like a Punisher crime kind of thing, you know, revenge. There's a murder mystery we're trying to follow. There's a whole serial killer. You know what I mean? Like, it's a serial killer storyline that we're following. There's corruption. There's the whole, you know, social commentary on war. There's, you know, the whole space race thing that he brings into it. I mean, there's so much packed into these six issues, but yeah. It's really fascinating. But I wanted to go back, Tom, real quick to something you mentioned about, like, you know, martial law is no different than the rest of these superheroes. It's just he's been given a different purpose. And when you said that, it really struck me as interesting because, you know, I think that's a, like, some themes, or that's a theme in this book, is like, you know, the people that are really pulling the strings, they're just, how do we give these guys purpose? We have these like super incredibly powerful weapons that now we have to deal with. And it's like, well, they had a purpose when they were at war. We gave young men purpose, and that's how we got to them to go to war. Now they're home. Well, what do we do with them? We got to give them a purpose. So it's like, okay, we're going to turn them into superheroes, or we're going to take some of them and turn them into cops that chase down the rogue superheroes that don't have any purpose. Or we're going to, you know, like, there's a religious aspect into some of this. There's all these different, you know what I mean? All these different things. It's like, there's definitely an undertone of like purpose equals control. You know, like, if we can give someone a purpose, that means we can control them. And I really didn't see that until you mentioned that. That's a fascinating, you know, sort of undercurrent of this book that I hadn't. And that's what this fucking book, there's so much in this book. It's just, even reading it now, like I said, I picked this up in single issues when it came out, when I was 16 years old, and read it then. And I read it again now, you know, in preparation for this. And it's like, I picked up stuff again at 50 that I didn't pick up when I was 16, and I didn't pick up when I was 25 when I read it a second time, and then maybe when I was 35 or something when I read it a fourth time, you know. And it's really like one of those books. I knew I loved it when I read it the first time, but I'm kind of like loving it more and more as I get older and just like seeing how great it really is. And also sort of fascinated with, like, I know people love it, but it's not talked about in the same way of like Watchmen or Dark Knight or those books. And I kind of think it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it wasn't released by DC, you know, its distribution was probably way lower than either one of those books. But, you know, I bet if you talk to Garth Ennis, if you talk to Brian Bendis, if you talk to, you know, any of those, the creators who's, I don't want to call it derivative, but certainly influenced by this, you know, I bet they would wax poetic about it forever.
I think part of it's probably because it doesn't fit quite neatly into, you know, like stylistically something like Watchmen, you know, for being groundbreaking, looks like a Dave superhero Gibbons. Looks like a superhero book, or it lives in that world, right? Like, you can look at it and be like, oh, okay, like, I recognize that, you know. Like, Dark Knight lives in that, like, I mean, obviously Frank Miller's art's fantastic, but it's born of that world, and it almost feels like Kevin O'Neill's isn't quite born of that same world. Like, it's like a different, like, a way of, you know, like, I keep going back to, like, all of their costumes are dumb, are just like, they're goofy. Yeah. They're like, they're ridiculous. They're born.
They're also like dirty. They're like dirty. Like, they're, they look more like what if somebody ran around in a superhero costume would look like.
Yeah.
Like, it would be bunched up and it wouldn't fit right. And you wouldn't, like, nobody's in that kind of shape all the time. And, like, you would look ridiculous. You would look absolutely fucking ridiculous running around in a costume like that.
Yeah.
It's almost they don't look
imposing.
It doesn't want to, like, speak like superhero language the same way that even a Watchman, you know, like when they're in costumes, you know, yeah, they make some jokes about, you know, all men being kind of fat or, you know, like that stuff. But like, it's still within that language, right? And this feels like a little bit of like, actually, no, we're not going to like even
pretend,
like pretend like that costumes yeah. would look good or cool or like, you know, like, I mean, it's just, it's so, it's funny because when you read maybe the book, you get lost a little bit and you forget that Marshall Law's costume is dumb. And it's weird. It'll be like a full page spread where you're like, oh yeah, that's right. He's got like a leather mask on with like a zipper. Well, he's in a convenience store, like getting food, you know, like it's like,
yeah.
And it's funny because it's like, yeah.
Fear and loathing on his chest.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Like yeah, superhero yeah. costumes would be dumb, would be ridiculous and like weird yeah. looking. And like, yeah, it's like, walking around what? Dressed in like an S&M costume isn't a yeah. million miles away from, you know, like superhero leather X-Men.
And outfits, I wonder, you know? I wonder if that's really, because this is a book, like, you know, we've talked about this in the past. Like, you could read Watchmen, and if you want to ignore all the things that it's saying negatively about superheroes, mm-hmm. you can't. Like, people read it's that book and they love yeah. Rorschach, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you could read The Dark Knight Returns and walk away with that with a very positive view of Batman.
Yeah.
But you can't read this book and yeah, come away like, with anything other than superheroes are stupid. Like, superheroes are yeah. dumb. There's no
disease. They are a disease and I am the cure.
There's no bacteria. Like, surface level. Like, oh, this is just a cool Batman story. Or like, oh, right. watch what, that's a cool superhero story. I didn't even yeah. read the pirate stuff in the back. I just read this, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's not, that's not an avenue in this story. You know, like,
there's no escaping it. There's
yeah, no escaping. Yeah. He like makes these huge panels of this guy in a leather mask. Like, you can't ignore it. It's like, he's making it look like it's like fundamentally ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
They
yeah.
don't ever let like, you escape it.
Although yeah, another... I will say 16-year-old me probably thought martial law was pretty badass.
Oh, sure.
I don't know that I walked away from martial law going, oh, that, you know, it's ridiculous. Like, no, at 16 in 1987, I was probably like that. Yeah. He's a badass. He's yeah,
you're looking for leather, all leather outfits.
Yeah.
But, I don't think I understood it, but
another book I was thinking of while we were reading this, and you know, it's very different, but I think also influenced by this would be Top 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. It's all like, the superhero, everyone has superpowers, yeah. kind of a thing. Yeah, yeah. I think so. There's a you
police
know
story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't. I think, you know, I think all those guys had to some degree been influenced by 2000 AD, right? Like Judge Dredd in 2000 AD, and you know, they all grew up. That was what they grew up reading, really. And so, you know, as you said, Chris, you know, Pat Mills is called the godfather of British comics, and I think, you know, just that sensibility that, you know, he doesn't hide it at all of his complete fucking disdain for a lot of, you know, Western superhero comics and superhero characters. Like, that's what this book is all about. Like, his mm-hmm. fucking hatred of that shit and sort of pointing out how fucking ridiculous and silly it can be. Which I'm sure a lot of fans, it's hard for them to sort of face that and, you know, and, you know, sort of look at themselves to some degree, but it's like, you know, anything can be looked at that way. You know what I mean? Like anything mm-hmm. people love, you can also find why it's stupid or why it's silly. There's nothing, I don't know that there's anything that is sacred in that sense, but
I think part of it's like, there's like an essential Britishness to it of like, I think when you, there's like, I think you treat things differently when it's imported to you and you kind of look at it and you think like, this kind of stupid, like this thing that,
right,
you know, that like, when you look at anything, like, you know, I always think about like, have you guys ever read like those black and white, like Captain Britain ones that used to, those stories that used to be like in the, like whatever the weird Marvel collections that they would have, you know, in Britain, those, you know, those ostensibly are taking part in the Marvel universe, but like they have a totally different point of view of like what superheroes are. And like, they are kind of a, like a little bit of a joke about, I mean, superheroes are so American, right? They're so like, like the, and that self-seriousness and that sort of like, you know, like even at its most basic, like the sort of like optimism of a Superman, you know, imagine having that imported to you and being like, what is this? Like this weird otherworldly, like optimism and sort of like Pollyanna-ish, like viewpoint.
Well, it's American, you know, exceptionalism. Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
that's essentially
yeah.
what superheroes are. It's American exceptionalism. And so when that's, you know, it's like, I think it's a, it's also a difference in like the culturally nerdy stuff, and not just comics, but you see it all the time in anything. Nerd culture is so protective of the culture, of the things that they love.
Of course.
And yet, you know what I mean? Like they can't, you know, the British can kind of like laugh at something they love. Like they can take the piss out of something, but still love it. And Americans, you know, it's like, I think because we grow up so, at least nerds, we grow up so sort of like afraid that someone's going to find out we like something that really they might not approve of. We can't really make fun of it. We have to, it's a sacred cow to us and we can't.
Yeah, defend it to the end.
Yeah. Where I don't think, yeah, I think they don't have that same feeling about something where it's like, no, you know, you can kind of look at something honestly and yet still love it. Like you can say how stupid it is and silly and point, you know, at all the flaws of it, but still love something. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I think we, you know, that's just an American thing too, of like, no, we're the best. And if we're, because if you're not the best, your shit, you know, there's no garbage. Middle ground. There's there's nothing in between there. But well, I'm glad you guys liked it. I, like I said,
loved it. I didn't like it. I loved it.
Yeah. This was one of those like formative comics for me, you know, like this and American Flag and Watchmen and that kind of stuff that just really changed the idea of what comics were for me. And so I was excited to see what you guys thought about it. Cause I thought I figured you would like it. I mean, it's so smart and funny.
We should read American Flag next.
Oh boy. Well, that's a problem is it's like 50. You know, first
yeah. It's like
line.
The first, yeah. It's like the first story arc. It's
yeah. Yeah.
Somewhere I don't think I've ever read it all the way through. It's an awesome piece of work.
Yeah,
I always bottom out around like the 20th issue or something.
Well, I don't know whose pick is next, but you know, whoever's pick it is.
Say Tom, pick American Flag.
American Flag.
American, the first story arc of American Flags or whatever that is. First.
I love that story. Yeah.
Oh, you don't have to sell me on it. I'll read. I've read it. I've read it all the way through. You know, probably 3 or 4 times in my lifetime.
Yeah, whatever the first
50.
I don't think the arc. First. How long is it? I feel like it's not like a 6.
I want to say. No, I think it's like 3 issues or something. I want to say the first story arc is, but I can't remember exactly.
We'll read around the first 6, whatever makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I got this. Sounds good. All right, American Flag it is.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. I was going to pick something else, and then I just decided to do that. I'll say
yeah. If you don't have this, it's the I don't know if they called it the omnibus, but it's that hardcover collection. It's awesome. Oh, and signed by Howard Chaykin.
I got my single issue somewhere behind me.
You didn't get a Rick Flag sketch in your signed
it? No, like I did? He was. Oh, you got a Rick Flag sketch in yours?
I got a Rick Flag sketch.
Nice. Well,
it's been a while.
You chatted him up. You were like, "Sir, I love you. You're the best."
It's been a while since.
No, he. You know what? My meeting with Howard Chaykin was the greatest, like meet your hero kind of meeting, because I did definitely go up there super nervous, and you know, because Chaykin was one of those guys you kind of always heard stories about. He was kind of gruff and. Not, you know, easy to get along with. And so I went up there like, you know, very nervous and handed him my book to sign. And he just wanted to start talking about movies and TV shows. Yeah. And I sat there and talked with him for, yeah, I don't know, 45 minutes and just had this amazing fucking conversation with him.
Yeah.
And he was as awesome as anybody could be, you know, in that moment.
One of those great stories where your hero is actually awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, American Flag is awesome. I love it. It's been cool. It's about time that I reread the whole thing, so
perfect
time.
I was buying original art for a while until it just got, you know, I ran out of space on the walls and it got really expensive. One of the pages I will always regret not buying is that it was one of the art dealers at a C2E2 had the diplomatic immunity page. Mm. And it was more than I wanted to spend, but way less than it probably is going for now.
Yeah, right. For sure.
Yeah. Will Pfeiffer still is just like, oh, you should have bought that.
Should have bought it.
Yeah, you know how many pages I could say that about if I had any money at the time, but yeah, for sure. Cool.
Well,
there you go.
You bought a book that we had, or you picked a book that we had way too much to talk about because we were going to dive into the DC movie and TV and all that, video games and the whole James Gunn universe. We'll have to save that for next week.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll talk about it next week. There's some interesting news from James. Well, we do have a couple of minutes. So, okay, if there was, say, a martial law, like HBO Max, television series, who would you cast? Let's just like martial law. Who would you cast as martial law? Who would you cast as you know, Celeste? And the what's the main guy's name? Colonel.
Oh, public spirit.
Public spirit. And then I don't know whoever else you'd want to cast in. Any ideas on?
It's like Marshall. He's got to be pretty big.
I was thinking like what's his name? He's a little old now, but Clive Owen would have been good. Maybe Tom Hardy could do it. I suppose.
Am I going to throw out the standard Tom Hardy suggestion?
I think he's, like, I just don't, he seems so monotone though. Like American Flag has I don't know.
In a weird way, like Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt? No, I don't see that.
he's too white bread. But that's the character. He's kind of like a white bread American boy who went and got completely scarred by war.
Actually, I could almost see Ben Affleck if you just make him play it straight.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, just play it straight and. You could, because he could just be that kind of dumb, like, you know.
How about Ryan Gosling? How about Ryan Gosling?
Oh, give me one second, guys. I got to run. My kids are.
Well,
my kids busted in. Okay.
I'll see you guys. We got a break. All right, Tom. We'll talk to you later.
Jailbreak.
Have a good one.
Jailbreak.
Hilarious.
That's funny.
There's lots of people, you know. Amy Adams is Celeste. I don't know. It's
Amy Adams, Margot Robbie,
Margot Robbie, because Margot Robbie is good in anything, right?
Yeah.
You said was she in Babylon?
Yeah. Oh, whew, she's all over Babylon.
Yeah.
She's on fire in Babylon. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. It's, man, it's just got raked over the coals.
Listen,
here's the bad marketing.
No, I don't know about bad marketing, but I think one, people have expectations of a movie when you have big stars in it, and mm-hmm. it's going to be like, people are complaining. The biggest complaint I heard about Babylon was like, there's too much going on. And it's like, it's a fucking movie called Babylon.
Yeah.
Like, it's literally about, like, you know, the chaos of, you know, decadence. Like, that's what Babylon suggests, right? Yeah. Like the city of Babylon and the fall of Babylon. And this is about the decadence of the 1920s Hollywood. And so, yeah, there's a ton of shit going on. It's
I think chaotic. People have trouble paying attention.
It's, yeah, for sure. Yeah. If it's right. not 6 second clips on fucking TikTok, people,
if, it, if it's it. Not something that I'm not going to mention any names, like my wife, who has trouble, like just sitting in front of the TV, watching a movie without a tablet or a phone or a laptop. Right. Yeah.
You can't just do like, two things at once. Go to the theater and see a movie. Yeah. But I really enjoyed it. I can see it's not for everybody. It's not, you know, it's not the kind of movie for everybody, but I don't know. I mean, it's not a perfect movie. It's a flaw, you know, it has flaws. It's not, I don't think it's the best movie of the year. For me, as someone who, one, loves movies, two, loves the history of Hollywood, and three, loves when a director, like, takes a big swing at shit.
Swings for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all your wheelhouse.
Yeah. And so for me, it's like, I would rather have that. It's way more interesting of a movie than, you know, 10 fucking Top Guns. You know what I mean? Like some fucking mindless pap that just like is redoing another fucking movie and just like, you know, pulls at your heartstring nostalgia chords. Okay, great. If that's all you can handle is a fucking movie, then don't go see Babylon. You're not going to enjoy it. But if you actually like, you know, want to be entertained visually in a different way, like actually want to, you know, see someone do something on screen that maybe you haven't seen before, or, you know, have a character do things that you wouldn't expect them to do, or, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's beautiful. It's super long. I mean, it's like it's over 3 hours, but it really didn't, for me, it did not feel like 3 hours. Cause it just moves along really quickly, and it is chaotic and insane, but so was like 1920s filmmaking was chaotic and insane. And you know, but yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
It's on the list. You know, talking about, you know, it's weird in that you can love something, and whenever like public opinion turns away from it, it's actually sometimes nice because you feel like you see the brilliance in it and you kind of want to own that a little bit. And like this past week, The Last of Us, the episode 3 is so good and so brilliant. And I was almost sad that I got on my news feed the next morning and there's like 12 stories about how brilliant this episode is. And it's like, no, you know, it's
I enjoyed the episode. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah.
I thought it's probably the best representation of a true gay relationship.
Yeah,
you like know, as far as a sense of
monogamous,
just like a regular
honest relationship.
Yeah, but like, and I love the actor. Obviously, what's his name is terrific and everything.
Ron Swanson.
I can't think of. Right, yeah, he's amazing. But the other actor,
who played Frank. Yeah,
yeah, he's shown up in like the last three series that I've watched. He's been in. Which is just funny. The other guy, the other actor who I should know his name, but I don't know
the
guy
who plays Frank,
but like we watched Welcome to Chippendales, where he plays mm-hmm. the choreographer who started helped start the Chippendales dance clubs.
Okay.
He plays that guy and he's fucking amazing. He's probably my favorite character. And he has once again, like a truly sincere gay, he was bisexual, but he has a truly sincere, like heartbreaking gay relationship in that show. And then he was in White Lotus, the first season of White Lotus. I haven't watched the second season. He's in this. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Was he the hotel manager?
Yeah, he was the hotel manager.
Okay.
And he's awesome. But he's a terrific actor. And it was really good. But I was thinking about it like, you know, people, like you said, everybody's talking about that episode. It's all anyone's been talking about since it came out. It just, everyone's just, you know, saying how great it was, amazing. It's, you know, people are calling it the best episode of television ever. It's like, okay.
I think it's Emmy worthy, you know, but, for consideration, you know, it's slow your roll, right?
Yeah.
You're talking to Mr. Hyperbole Hill here. And I'm just like, slow your roll, folks.
I was just sort of thinking about, I'm like, would anyone care about it if it was a man and a woman?
Oh, I think it would have been emotionally, you know, arresting, and would have been a great story. It's just that there's not, I think so. If it's the same story with a man and woman, I think it is. I think the story was strong.
I don't think anyone's talking about it as like,
I don't care about that, but you're asking about quality. I think that you can tell that same story or a very similar story with a male and female relationship and have it still be a quality story. I think that it snuck up on people in a zombie show based on a video game that you have an incredibly poignant monogamous gay relationship with two later middle age and then, you know, approaching elderly characters. I think it was the surprise factor that kind of added to that. You don't expect that kind of TV show to have that kind of story. And I think that's why people are just like, whoa.
Right. Yeah. But I'm wondering, like, and this was just me sort of questioning my own like thoughts on it. Like, is it really, really good and an amazing episode of television, or is it just because it was sort of surprising and unexpected and we haven't seen it before?
Yeah. Yeah. All of that. I think it was really good. I think that's why the internet is freaking out because we haven't quite seen it live, right?
Now, if it was The Walking Dead, you know what would have, you know what, how it would have been different? Is that Frank would have used his sexual manipulation and murdered Bill.
Bill.
After.
Yeah.
That would have been The Walking Dead scene. That is like, he would have, because even as I was watching it, I was like, I don't know if I trust this guy. You know,
right? He absolutely used that. He manipulated Bill because he's trying to survive. Because he's even like, okay, if we do this, I get to stay for a couple of days, right?
Right.
That was all there.
But The Walking Dead, he would have killed him.
Bill would have been dead. Bill would have been dead.
That would have definitely been the difference between The Last of Us
and The Walking
Dead. It was a terrific.
That happened in the video game. Bill and Frank are real characters from the video game.
Well, they are, but there was no.
This is like backstory, right? So this is where the TV show.
There was no implicit. It was suggested that they were that they were.
Did you play Last of Us? Have you played Last of Us? Yeah, it's awesome. Yep. It's a great.
It's game. It's my daughter's favorite video game.
It's it's
no, amazing. They were characters in it, but they weren't. I mean, it wasn't ever expanded on.
Yeah.
That they had a relationship, and Bill was a much different character in the game than he was in.
Nick Offerman is an amazing survivalist. It's him coming out of the door with a shotgun.
He fucking, you know, he builds canoes and shit like in his as a hobby. So he could probably do most of that shit in real life.
That's why he's perfect for this. And it's like whenever they're in like the arsenal bunker, you're like, Nick Offerman knows what each one of those fucking guns are.
The only thing I was like, Linda Ronstadt? Really? It's the Linda Ronstadt song? Everybody like that? That's what they're fucking connecting on? I don't know about
they're
that
They're gay. Okay.
Linda Ronstadt.
You know? Yeah. But no, it's good. I love that show. I'm really into Pascal is doing, and Anna Torv, who I haven't really seen since Fringe. I didn't even recognize her as Tess until
I was just like,
oh shit, that's Anna Torv.
Yeah, I love Anna Torv, and I was upset because I'm like, oh, she's not gonna be around long. Yeah. And you know what I mean? Like when I first saw her, I'm like, ah, because I really like her. Like I really, really like her. And I'm like, oh, she's not gonna be around fucking long. That sucks. Cause I would have loved to have her in this show.
Yeah. So I love that they do some flashback stuff. They even do like the weird de-aging flashback stuff.
Did where, they? I don't remember.
Well, yeah, because it's like Pascal and Anna Torv and Nick Offerman. I mean, they aged them a lot. Pedro Pascal looked like Game of Thrones, what the Crimson Tiger or whatever the hell he was, the Red Scorpion, you know, and it was like Fringe era Anna Torv. Like 10 years ago.
Was it?
It's look at the watch, friend. It's been a while.
10 years, 10 years goes by fast.
Right? It does. And my dad says life is like a roll of toilet paper. Goes really fast at the end.
I bet. I'm not there yet, hopefully. No, it was good. Yeah, it's a great show. Yeah. It's a great and like I said, I'm certainly not trying to like shit on it because it was I think it was to me the most honest representation of a gay relationship I've ever seen on screen. Like it didn't have, you know, they were just, it was believable. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like they were two men that fell in love with each other. And
we've had good days and bad days, more good days than bad.
Yeah. But
there's been times where I've wanted to fucking strangle you.
Right. Right. Yeah. And
that's marriage.
That's what I appreciated of it. It was just like, it wasn't, you know, sort of this, you know, there's this overcompensation in storytelling with anything that has to do, once again, going back to like sacred cows and protecting the things we love. And so it's like, oh, well, I'm going to tell a story of my relationship that, you know, whether it's a gay relationship or lesbian relationship, or if it's a racial, you know, thing or whatever it is. And it's like, this overcompensation for it because of like, well, this is my only chance. So I'm going to sort of overcompensate and hopefully.
Well, and that's the whole thing of
that.
Well, that's the letting agenda get ahead of storytelling. And
right.
You know, I was emotionally, you know, rocked by this episode, not because it was pushing this, you know, this, you know, ideology or agenda, but because it was this amazing heartfelt story about these two people who loved each other and you became, you know, attached and invested.
You saw their life together. Yeah.
It's what,
like any other relationship. Good
storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I agree. On the other hand, it's like I watched Wakanda Forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize. I know it's Black History Month, but that movie is kind of a pile of shit.
Really? I was going to watch it this weekend.
The best part of it to me was the they're not Atlanteans anymore, but what would be the Atlanteans? Namor. And I thought they were actually the best part of it, but yeah, I didn't think, I mean, there's a couple of moments that are, you know, tribute to Chadwick Boseman. And those are, you know, emotional. But the rest of the movie is just like kind of boring. The fight scenes were not great. And then there's this like, you know, just there's good parts to it. The music in it is awesome. And it looks, you know, amazing, but it's just like as a movie, like as a story, it's kind of not really great. I didn't really think it was.
Well, it's one of the things I'm excited. We don't want to talk too much about it because we're going to talk about it next week. But reading, you know, interviews from James Gunn about what they're planning with DC, knowing that Tom King is in the writer's room and that they basically have a 10 movie and TV series outline pretty much, you know, scripted out at this point, gives me a lot of hope that we're going to see some really well told DC stories.
Yeah, that worries me a little bit, though. And we could talk about this next week a little more, but it worries me in the sense of like, oh, well, we have to have the next decade figured out of what we're going to do. Okay.
Yeah.
But
you can handcuff yourself. You can handcuff yourself.
Yeah. Right? It's like, well, what if it's not good? You know, like, what if you got 10 years of shit then? Like,
yeah, you know, then what you end up like, with Zack Snyder for a decade.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just like, well, let's hope that it's good if you're going to plan it out that far ahead.
And James Gunn is not flawless. He's made movies that I don't think are great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No,
he's made some of my favorite. Yeah.
No director is flawless. No director is flawless. Nate, you know, there isn't one. But yeah, we'll talk about that next week for sure. Yeah.
All right. Everyone, thank you for listening to our really fun discussion on martial law. Sal, thanks for suggesting that. Check out American Flag. We're going to read about the first 6 issues. It was they didn't write for the trade back in them days. So
we're going to read 50 issues. We got to read the first 50.
The whole omnibus. So yeah, we'll be talking about American Flag soon. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/randomcomics. Shoot us an email. Join the comment section during our live streams, all that good stuff. We will be back again next Thursday. In the meantime,
in between time,
we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
I am the law.
Fear and loathing. Come on.